Well, hello there. It's Tim, and you're listening to episode 5 of the Newsletterers series, where I try to find out some of the how and the why behind popular newsletters. In this episode, I'm joined by Paul Orlando, who creates Unintended Consequences to explore how good intentions can lead to hell, among other things.
So, Paul, how about you introduce yourself one more time and share a little bit of your story so far as it relates to how you became to publishing Unintended Consequences as an email newsletter?
Okay, thank you, Tim. So, I'm Paul Orlando. I do a few things. So, I teach entrepreneurship at the University of Southern California. I run the on-campus startup incubator, although it's now a virtual incubator, I suppose, as everything is. Over the last, about 8 years at this point, I've been in that type of a world, meaning working with a lot of startups. So I ran a startup accelerator in Hong Kong, another one in Rome, kind of made a specialty of helping founders build their businesses, understand what they need to do, who their customers are, how they, think about business models. So, that is a bit about me, but doesn't seem to intersect with this newsletter, I suppose, just yet. The other thing about me is I enjoy writing, and I think I've, just liked to write, for as long as I remember. But this newsletter has been the first time that I've actually set a regular cadence to when I would generate, output. Before doing the newsletter, I've written blog posts. Certainly I wrote something that I, collected into a book about, 6 years ago at this point. But those experiences have been pretty different than writing this newsletter, and the point that I came to that led me down this path, directly led me down the path of writing about unintended consequences, was seeing a friend's startup, which had a friend of mine had built a startup and had a launch video for it, and it was very much like something that was called Google Duplex, except he had done this about a year before. And if you don't know what this what Google Duplex is, it's about this was a project from Google, maybe about 2 years ago at this point, where it's a voice AI, and a number of use cases for this. But if you can imagine being able to at scale replace the human experience of calling a business up, to ask a set of common questions, and that might be booking a table in a restaurant, ordering flowers, from a florist, checking the, checking whether a store is open or not. I
remember a bit of an ethical freak out about that as well. As people were kind of concerned that you couldn't tell that you were talking to a robot.
Exactly.
What did that mean?
Yeah, exactly. And so when I saw this, the demo from Google, and I'd already seen my friend's demo, which had been maybe a year before the Google demo, of course, it was an object of a lot of making fun of my friend, because he had already decided to shut down his old startup, and of course it was you didn't wait long enough, here it is, or timing issue. But I, at that point, I just started thinking about, well, what would the world look like if, a voice AI is indistinguishable from, a human on the other side of the phone? You can interact with the voice AI, not know, are you talking to a human or not? Or maybe you don't care. And what are some of the conclusions that we might draw from that? What might the world look like? Because of that. And within a day, or I think actually an afternoon, I went out, I registered a domain name, I wrote up that first piece, posted it, and sent it to my friend. And you know, that was the start. That was, I think, in fact, I will look it up, but I think that was 2 years ago next month. And
did you see traction right away with the concept?
No. I saw, so first of all, it was a one-off post. I did not immediately follow it up, you know, like a week later with the second one. I saw some interest in it. So I posted, I sent it to my friend via Twitter. You know, he tweeted it around. I did see some, you know, like some readership, but to be honest, at that point, I wasn't even collecting emails. Like there was no subscribe field. I had just thrown up this website, you know, the same day. You know, I wasn't, you know, even thinking about doing a newsletter. If I remember right, the way I set the site up also, you know, unless you knew the exact like link for that one page, you could not find it. So I had no directory of posts. You know, you wouldn't default to a blog, like a collection of blog posts. So so it was pretty hastily done, and just because I got this burst of energy in you know, seeing some things online, really quickly wrote, if I remember correctly, I wrote this piece up like super fast. It just kind of like flowed from me, and didn't expect that I would be still doing this almost 2 years later. I suppose I hadn't thought about what I would be doing. You know, I just thought it would be something fun to start with, and I might even see if I can check here. When was the next thing that I wrote? But
so it sounds like a pretty organic way to get started.
Yeah, it certainly was.
And out of curiosity, do you have that? I mean, I heard about academia. There's that kind of publish or die thing. Is that a pressure that applies to you as a professor?
No, I'm so in the U.S. This is not like, you know, everywhere, I suppose this doesn't apply, but in the US there are different types of professors. So some have a research component to what they do. So some might be very much research or exclusively research. Some are both research and teaching, and some are focused on teaching. So my, appointment at the university is I teach a couple classes, but I also run the startup program. So I'm not publishing hard research. In fact, I'm operating also in the field of entrepreneurship, which, well, it certainly does have research that's produced, but I'd say the research is a little less a part of that field than it would be in biotech, in medicine, and many other areas that are more research driven. But so this is, this project is really completely separate from the work I do, at the university.
But also probably the thinking through of and imagining unintended consequences is probably a skill that has been kind of co-developed with some of the other skills that you need to be successful in your work.
I think there's overlap, and some of it, might just be sticking with something long enough so that you build up, just a bit of competence, and enough people know that you're doing it. One of the things that I struggled with a little early on was what exactly is this project that I have taken a first step towards? It's pretty, it's a pretty fuzzy boundary, on, unintended consequences. Yeah. It kind of intersects with a lot of different things, or maybe everything in one way or another.
Yeah. And so talk a little bit about thinking that through, my experience with, my personal writing project is or one of the things I like about doing them online in like an open kind of format is that you think through the project as you go. So the boundaries kind of emerge from the writing itself. Is that similar to your experience or
it,
you a different?
It has been. The way I think about this unintended consequences blog is it must continue to be fun for me. This is not a grind, like a job that I'm doing, you know, because I am, because I have to do it. This is really something that helps me learn it, you know, and that learning might mean that I just learn about a new historical, fact that I wasn't aware of before. In some cases, it means that I understand more about systems and how to appreciate the interconnectedness of, you know, different actors in a system. I guess like the far, like, you know, in, I don't know if it's in third place or in fifth or in 10th place for me in this project has been, well, how do I make sure that people know about this?
Right.
And, you know, that's probably the one that I have, or the facet that I've, I guess, taken the least amount of, effort in trying to figure out, you know, I didn't even, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I was going to ask why you think that is, but you started to say I didn't even.
Well, yeah. So I guess my thought, I think, is in the same lines of what you were going for. So I didn't even like add my name to this site until just a few weeks ago.
Right.
I didn't tell any of my friends about it apart from like if I was writing about them, like in the case of like that first blog post. But I didn't tell people about this. I didn't tell people I knew about it anyway. People would find it. You know, I might post things on Twitter to really minimal interaction. But I really just felt that I didn't know enough yet, and I wanted to build up some level of competence.
Competence in the process, or competence in the subject matter, or competent, what kind of competence do you mean?
Certainly competence in the subject matter. Like, I didn't know if what I was writing was really any good. And maybe also, I suppose, I didn't really know that I could commit to anything just yet. So I didn't kick things off by saying, you know, okay, I've written one, and therefore I pledge that I'm going to write one a week, you know, forever. I felt a little bit like, ooh, I don't know that I can commit to that. The next one might not be as easy as the first. But as I'm looking now, so I've actually gone through the history, I see, how about that? I actually did write one a week after. And then I wrote the third one just a few days after that. But, and then it's a week later. And then I'm, so I wrote a number, a week apart. But then I see a bit more of a gap. So there's a gap of more than a month. Yeah, I guess I wrote five, and then there's a gap of like a month. And so I still have not started sending this as a newsletter at that point. I can probably look this up, but I didn't start sending the newsletter until, I'm going to say, I had written maybe, I don't know, 20 of these.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about, you said it has to be fun. It can't be a grind. And the level of commitment was at the weekly thing was like a bit of a stretch, but you did more or less stick with it. So can you talk a little bit about what it was about weekly that helped you get there, or how you arrived at a weekly as the thing you were going to try for?
Right. It was pretty pragmatic. I subscribed to other newsletters. Some of them, the more intense ones, or the ones that are paid, are like, many of them are daily, or even like multiple times a day they'll send something out. And I just knew that was way beyond what I would be able to commit to. I might have a flurry of activity where I could maintain that for 1 week and then like I'd crash the next week. I just thought I personally knew if I have this other work that I'm doing, you know, at the university, I have a limitation on time. I have kids, you know, I have a limitation on time. So I thought once a week was doable. And at the same time, you know, there's other newsletters that are once a month, say, or, you know, they are not published on a regular schedule. And I thought if I went to something less frequent than once a week, so if I went to like less, you know, like once a month, I thought, you know, this is going to fizzle out. I'm going to, or I might like leave writing the new piece until the day before. So 29 days will have gone by and I'm not really building competence. I'm just periodically returning to the same idea and I'm not really going deep. And at the same time, you know, if there's no regular schedule, I didn't think that I would keep myself honest. And I also just wondered, would the readership, you know, value it in the same way? So I figured it has to be some type of regular schedule, but it's got to be also just doable for my life. And
sure,
that's how I came to once a week.
Yes, kind of like almost a process of elimination.
Sure.
That did weigh in the kind of relationship with an audience and the kind of relationship with an audience that you wanted to have.
That's right.
So the first one was, it just came to you like a flash of inspiration.
Yep.
Have they all gone like that, or how do you kind of work through all the possible ideas to arrive at the one you're going to focus on every week?
So I will tell you, now you've heard about the first, I'll tell you about the second. And okay. So the second one, and I wouldn't have known this was the second one had I not actually gone back in the history here. So the second one is called the Cobra Effect. And I came to this topic. So this is, you know, basically the concept where a solution that's created actually makes the problem that's trying to solve, makes it worse. And I had not heard of this term before, but I did what any reasonable person would do back in these early days. I went to Wikipedia and I typed in the term unintended consequences and I found, whoa, there's a whole list of all types of unintended consequences. And I saw this was one of them. And I read, you know, about this effect. And interestingly for me, you know, the way people tended to write about the cobra effect was with cobras, but other animals as well. Like it was always like, you know, like, you know, different types of animals. We have problems with, you know, animals, you know, encroaching upon human habitats, or maybe, you know, the reverse.
So would an example of this be the cane toad thing in Australia?
Exactly. And okay. I wrote about that problem. You're based in Australia, so you know about that. I wrote about that problem in a different piece, but that's certainly an example. That, you know, that was an animal that was imported to Australia to try to solve the, it was some kind of a grub, if I remember.
Cane beetle.
Yeah, cane beetle.
Cane beetle.
And things did not work out as planned.
Nope.
So I actually wrote about that, you know, in a different piece. But just to complete the thought, so like I, as a part of just learning more and as a source of ideas, I had this long list from Wikipedia of types of unintended consequences. And what I did in the case of the Cobra Effect article, I actually, this was really the first time I'd say I actually did some research. And I actually, for a day, I kind of threw myself into this topic, finding everything from just looking at how there was a lack of evidence that, you know, there actually was a cobra bounty in British colonial India, you know, which, you know, which gave the name to this effect. You know, it also discusses like, you know, the rat infestation in, you know, French colonial Vietnam. So I end up like reading a bit about just the history of where some of these examples came from. But what I ended up doing, I hope anyway, is re-looking at or taken another look at this effect. And I actually proposed to some controversy that there actually is a way out of this unintended consequence. And
juicy.
Yeah, so that's what that's why I called the article "The Cobra Effect Redesigned." Hit post before I realized a better title would have been "The Cobra Effect with an Antidote." But anyway, that's, you know, that's too late.
Hindsight is 2020. Hey.
This post was the first one of mine that went, you know, viral, small scale. It didn't happen right then, but I, it was like 3 or 4 months later, I posted it to Hacker News. I posted it and like went to sleep. And, you know, the next morning I recently set up Google Analytics. Maybe I should take a look and see, you know, what happened with that post on Hacker News. And I saw like, whoa, people are actually reading this thing. And I saw I was on the front page of Hacker News, with like, you know, nothing more than me just posting the thing and going to sleep. And it was like the first. So by that time I had written a number, maybe I've written, I don't know, 10, you know, at that point. But it was that feedback from like an audience who, like, I don't know anyone who happened to randomly see, you know, the link and like, you know, click on it, and, you know, people were then upvoting it. It was that feedback that actually, you know, kept me going, I'd say. So like when I would post things and then they would become popular, I say with a lot of confidence, I would have given up on this project had I not seen that there were people who liked what I was writing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Can I ask, you said you were about 10 deep and you posted that one. Yep. So you'd written 10 posts before.
Right.
Is that because you suspected that that was gonna, that particular one was gonna do well with that audience, or how, like,
no,
did you have a gut feeling about it?
I don't think I was that intuitive. And I believe I had posted a few of them before, but to no reaction really. So I don't think I said, oh, this is really going to be the one. And to be honest, I think there's a lot of luck in posting to any kind of a, just like a list of links, something like Hacker News.
Sure.
You know, the luck of who happened to be on at that time and decided to upvote or, you know, or not. To be honest, I've had other posts that I thought were better and nobody likes them. So I don't know that I'm a great read on, you know, what people will like, or at least not yet. And to some degree, I think you have to say, you know, you kind of have to like not care too much about that, because, you know, you're certainly writing for yourself if you're doing a project like this. But if I had, I'll say this, like if I had never seen any positive reaction, so like if none of the posts had ever really gotten readership, I kind of think I eventually would have said, you know, maybe nobody is interested in this topic except me. And
how do you a bailout point in your mind? Like, did you say, I'll give this X amount of posts or X amount of months, or had you not really thought that?
You know, it's a great question. I always ask that question of startups that I work with. But in my case, you know, it started out as, this is something that's fun. I'm not doing this because it's a business. This is something that, you know, I think I become a little better at looking at complex systems because of it. And I learn about these, you know, really unusual occurrences in history, you know, because I go through this process. So I don't know if I, you know, I don't think I probably could have set an endpoint, because it didn't feel like that type of thing. It's not like, okay, I invest 1,000 hours and then it out comes this much return. It wasn't really like that. I just figured I would have given up because I would have probably, you know, gotten discouraged and tired, and I would have said, you know, I'm exhausted this week. I'm going to just not post anything. And it would have just lapsed.
Yeah. So, and it was the, again, kind of the relationship with an audience that kind of staves off that, that feeling of, whatever next, no, I'll skip it this time. It's you sort of start to feel like you have something together.
Exactly.
Can I ask, you said you didn't add a subscription form until about 20 posts in. Were you getting requests, or what kind of, what tweaked at around that point?
I don't think I was getting requests. The only thing that I think changed for me was just in, you know, just in thinking that, you know, that the people who I happened to have as readers in those early days would, they would just happen to find me. You know, so they might find me on Hacker News, or, you know, on Reddit, or, you know, they might, you know, happen to do some, like, some, you know, Google search that, you know, that led to me. And I thought, well, if some of these posts seem to be hitting people in a certain way to the point that they are, like, sharing them or upvoting them, I should at least try to build some regularity into how I do this. Yep. And I'd rather try to build, like, a repeat audience that I write for. And right now I have no idea who that audience is. So, I think it really just flowed from that.
So can we pause on that for a second? When you say you have no idea who the audience is, what do you mean?
Well, early on, unless someone was leaving a comment on, you know, on Hacker News, I suppose, I really had no idea who was reading it. You know, I might know where they were based, because I would, you know, eventually, you know, I would look at Google Analytics and say, okay, well, you know, in the last week or month, you know, where were readers coming from? And so I would see, you know, where they were around the world, but I didn't really know individually who is reading. And then, you know, I guess as I put up the, just, you know, added, you know, the field to collect emails, you know, I just, you know, I then, like, started, you know, to look at them periodically and say, like, oh, okay, here's some domain names that I recognize. Oh, okay, there's people from, oh, this is a, like, a government, you know, entity, or this is a university, or this is a company that I recognize, you know. So I'd start to kind of, you know, like, I don't know, piece together some of a picture, you know, a little bit of a picture there.
Sure.
And I don't know that it has yet changed what I write, except that, you know, at this point, people do respond to the, you know, to the weekly emails, and they send ideas to me, or they will say, like, oh, like, I, you know, this was something that I thought you might have, you know, added to that, you know, post, or you might want to, you know, think about this one if you return to the topic, you know, later on. So people will definitely write in. And I mean, I've actually, like, I've met a number of people from this project that I otherwise would have never met, because they happened to find it. They reached out, they shared what they're working on, you know, so, like, you know, I've had a number of calls, you know, with, you know, I haven't met anyone in person, you know, from this, but I guess that's also not going to happen for a while, probably, because coronavirus, but I've had a number of calls, or at a minimum email exchanges, with, you know, readers who I otherwise never would have known.
Well, we're on the subject of things that this project has brought into your life. Can you talk a bit about other things? Like, you've met some cool people, you kind of gained access to some ideas that, you know, they sent in. What else has doing this regularly over however long you've been doing it kind of given you that you don't think you otherwise would have had in your life?
That's a really good question. You know, I think this is probably one of the few regular habits that I have now, in the sense that, you know, different times in the past, you know, I maybe had more habits. Some of them might have been hobbies that I regularly practice, but I, you know, for, you know, number of reasons have, you know, set aside. So this, because it has a repeat nature to it, You know, it's something I do every week. You know, there's something that's a little soothing about it. And and even, you know, it also reminds me of music in a way. I know we were, you know, we were talking about music probably before you started to record, but you know, when I used to play music regularly with other people, and I played a lot of like improvisational jazz or jazz rock, you know, where it was largely, you know, you would not know what you were going to play or how a song was going to end up. And, you know, doing that in front of an audience would sometimes be a little scary because you think like, well, do we actually have something that we're really going to be able to say? And, you know, and how, we have no idea how it's going to end up in, you know, the next 10 minutes, half hour. And it's a little bit like this writing project. You know, every week, I might have a list of topics, just as like the kernel of, you know, an idea where I'm going to start, but I haven't really put time into writing them. You know, it's not like I have, you know, 10 drafts that are just waiting for me to hit publish. You know, I'm actually like going out, you know, each week and, you know, maybe taking that starter idea or maybe some notes that I've written down, but I'm really actually writing the entire thing, you know, very close to the time that I send it out. So, so there's something I think that's, I don't know, soothing, reassuring about that process. And then just knowing, okay, you know, people are going to read this. And
And I guess that differentiates it from something more like, I guess, a traditional academic publishing environment where there's a lot more lead time. There's a lot more, you know, back and forth before the real audience sees it.
Yes.
This is a bit more jazzy when you're doing a newsletter and a blog. It's kind of like makes the feedback loop a lot tighter.
I think so.
Between end user.
Yep.
Oh yeah. So you said that one of the things that it's given you in your life has been the kind of soothing element or the, I don't know, maybe it's like a Zen kind of Tai Chi type situation. So you have an email newsletter audience where you email them once a week. You have people who are visiting your blog, probably often driven from your weekly newsletter, but not entirely. And you have a social media following. Can you talk a little bit about how you see each of those? Do you see them kind of differently? Do you kind of grow them independently of each other? Do you interact with them in a different way? That kind of thing?
I think so. So I'm not super active on social media with this, or I'd say I will post on Twitter, but again, I'm just posting this to my own personal account, which is not like a huge number of followers. So, there's a little bit
of, I follow you.
Like there's a little bit of discovery there, but or like a little bit of dialogue with people who like write into me, say, via Twitter. I have not like really blasted my you know, like, I don't know, other accounts very much. I did it a little bit with a handful of posts that were popular, but I don't think I've really done that you know, all that much. The reason why might just be that I didn't think I was really seeing, like, I felt in the, you know, the first part of this project, I felt maybe a little uncomfortable that I didn't think I like, you know, wanted to be promoting myself. It kind of felt like that.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe like when I look back on it, I think maybe I was oversensitive. I have had a number of people like, just, you know, berate me and say like, yo, what are you thinking? Like, you should be like, you know, sending this out. Why do you not do it? So I think I was just like overly cautious there, but I kind of like, to be honest, I wanted people to like the work without knowing me, and or at least I wanted to see, okay, there are people who like the work without knowing me. Like they're not signing up or like, you know, liking it just because you know, they know me. So, and it took me like a long time to just get comfortable with that. Whereas, you know, I certainly think that I could have, you know, promoted this more aggressively, you know, really early on. Even.
Why do you think it was so important to you to have the writing stand alone?
There is so much content today.
Right? Yeah, true.
I mean, like, there's so much good content and also, like, even more, you know, like, content.
Rubbish.
Yeah. And I don't know, I felt like I want to leave things that, like, for example, one of the reasons that I don't, for the most part, cover anything that is like breaking news. And obviously with coronavirus, I've actually ended up writing a number of, you know, articles about it, but I'm not like trying to stay like, you know, up to the hour on, you know, breaking news on that or anything else. And the reason is like, I would want any individual post to, you know, be, you know, read a year from now or 10 years from now and still have somebody get value from it rather than think, oh,
that makes sense.
Like that's totally out of date or that, like, you know, that used to be the way things worked and it's no longer the way things work. So I'm going for that. And a lot of the writing that I see, you know, now is like, I figure, you know, this is no longer applicable. Or if I were to read this a month from now, you know, it has already like declined in value, you know. So
can I try that another way too?
Yeah.
I think that one of the thing that's become, if not a cliche, it's something about like the online writing that is so tied up with like some sense of a person's brand. So you kind of have the thinkers that are, you know, to pick the most obvious is Seth Godin, I guess. So it's like people read everything he publishes because it's him, kind of thing.
Right.
And it sounds like you were kind of deliberately trying to avoid that conflation of you and who your persona is and the ideas that you're writing about, because you didn't want to lean too heavily on the idea of like who you are to kind of imbue the writing with a sense of importance or something.
You've said that so elegantly and so much better than me. And
awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to think. So, you know, if I already had a massive following, would I not take as much care? Because I just figure like, oh, like this is going to work out no matter what. Maybe. And then on the other side, I guess, you know, I have certainly moved more slowly than I could have. You know, I think if I, you know, made each post, you know, 300 or words or 500 words instead of, you know, like 1500 or 2000 and, you know, didn't put research into it. Like I probably could crank out like, you know, 3, 4, 5 a week. But yeah, I don't know. It also just wasn't what I wanted to do. This wasn't me.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's something there too about like being able to stand the test of time. And I think, there are short things that stand the test of time quite well. I'm thinking of like, you know, lyrics and poetry.
Yeah.
Probably I maybe someone could disagree with me, but I can't think of many other things that are under, you know, 1,000 words or more that I would want to return to.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
Can you talk a little bit about once you did start kind of, you put the subscription thing in there and you kind of got, I don't want to say got over, but stopped being so cautious about promoting some stuff. Can you talk a bit about some things you've done to deliberately grow your audience?
The only things I've done have been posting to, you know, probably the only thing that I, you know, I that I post regularly to, or meaning if I have a new post, a new article, I will put it there at some point. So I put that on Hacker News. Once in a while on Reddit, Twitter, don't really use any other social media that much. Otherwise, I haven't done a whole lot. I do ask the readers who I have in the newsletter, I do ask them, and I don't think people are all that active in, responding to this, but I say, hey, if you like what I'm writing, share it with a friend. I haven't really said, hey, I'm trying to make this into something bigger. I've instead just said, if it's natural and, you want to share it, I would love, being in front of more people. So I haven't done a whole lot. And I mean, to be honest, at this point, there isn't, it doesn't make sense for me to, I think do anything financial with it.
Like buy ads or whatever.
I will experiment with that a little bit now that I think, ad rates have fallen, because of coronavirus. So, I wonder, am I really going to hit the right audience?
Can you talk a little bit, and if you don't feel comfortable sharing some of this stuff, that's fine, but can you talk a little bit about some of the milestones you've hit in terms of audience size and how you thought about them, and then maybe a little bit on the analytics side, what kind of numbers you're doing and where you've got to?
So let me take a look here.
That wasn't too euphemistic, was it?
So I'll give you some numbers are metrics that are around readership related, but also related to other publications. So, one of the things that I've been happy with has been seeing. So I look at the analytics once in a while, and then it'll often be the case where I realize too late, 3 days ago something was going on over here, what was that? And I'll start to look into it. So I've had the unintended consequences blog has been quoted in a number of other publications, some that I didn't even I had not heard of before, but it led to a lot of readers suddenly. So one is funnily enough, it's another newsletter, but it's apparently a massive one called The Browser, where I believe it is daily, where they send the five best things on the web of that day. So, and the only reason I knew about it and knew that I was in it was I looked at analytics one time. I think this was last summer maybe, and I discovered this piece that I wrote. It's getting all this traffic from this publication called The Browser. And let me just see what I'm trying to see. This was a piece that I wrote, last August, called Do We Create Shoplifters? And it was about automated checkouts and just the idea that putting somebody in that new situation where, they don't have to interact with a checkout clerk. There's some, there's benefits to that. It's not like we're saying, hey, that's a great job. Maybe there's some benefits to having people do more efficient work. And maybe there's some time efficiencies for the customer, but, apparently it also leads to other, other reactions
unintended consequences.
Exactly. All of a sudden morality is shifting. You're giving somebody the opening to be a shoplifter. Funnily enough, I look at this post, I've gone back to it, I think for the first time in, however many months, 6 months. And, I've got a photo that I took of a book, a picture in a book. And I'm looking at it. Misaligned, then I've got another picture that I found online of an accounting office. I have a screenshot of an Excel, like a very basic little table that I made in Excel. So it's not like a nice looking blog post now that I look at it.
Yep.
But for whatever reason, it hit, you know, the people who put together this other newsletter called The Browser, and it led to a lot of readers. And I'd say, if I remember correctly, you know, it was like high quality leadership, readership,
cool.
As in like a lot of people like signed up from, you know, visiting this page. There was another one. So I was in another newsletter also called Exponential View. And this was, the person who writes it, or I think it's a team of people that could write this. It's about, new technologies and, their impact on the future. And I had written a piece, I wrote like a couple of pieces on autonomous vehicles. And the systemic risk in autonomous vehicles. Usually when we hear about, AVs, they're always presented in, a positive way, as in, this is going to reduce the cost of transportation, and you'll be able to free people up from the risk of getting in a car accident. And then I actually started looking at some data and the overall system, and I came to the conclusion that operationally you can improve things a lot with the transportation system. But you also expose yourself to like massive systemic risk, and being able to shut down an entire fleet or an entire city, because of a bug or hacking. Or so that was a piece that was in this other newsletter called Exponential View. And then I think along the way things were quoted in the Human Risk newsletter, Marginal Revolution, and then
Sounds like the newsletter ecosystem has been good to you.
It has. And then like the last one, so like this, I had actually forgotten that this came about from some of the tweets that I was making. But a year ago, I think, I had made some tweets about efforts related to the eradication of malaria. And someone from TechCrunch, the publication, reached out to me and then asked if I wanted to write a post for them on that. So I wrote an article that was, kind of based on some other writing that I had done about malaria eradication efforts. And that was in, TechCrunch.
Nice.
So it's,
So we've got a guest, a little guest posting as a way.
Yeah, in one way or the other. I wouldn't say that any one post has been like massive. Like I'm still measuring things in like really in like the 5,000, visit kind of range for me is like, is like great. Or maybe like I'll see if I can kind of figure out.
Well, can you talk a bit about how many subscribers you're at now?
It's, I'm getting close to 1,000. So it's not like a huge list.
But it, at the same time, it's not that all 5,000 views are just coming from your newsletter audience either.
True. It's So I suppose most of the views are most of the views are non newsletter readers.
And do you know off the top of your head what you consider like a good open rate and a good click through on the newsletter side?
Open rates that I get are, I think, hovering around 40%.
Decent.
And I don't know about click-through. So, like, most of the people who open it, I figure they're just reading it as an email. Don't, unless they're clicking through one of the links, not many people click, like, the title and then go to read it on the web. For the most part, they read it, as an email.
So that even probably means that even less of your page views are coming from your newsletter subscribers,
right?
Because they're reading it in their email client.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
If you could start again, go back to that first post, knowing what you do now, what would you do differently on the way to get where you are now?
Well, I think I would probably be you know, just more upfront with, hey, this is a project that I'm doing, you know, maybe. And to be honest, I still kind of have not done this. It's still the kind of thing that I should probably do, that I just,
dude, Paul.
Yeah. Do I just go out to all my friends and then just write to them one by one and say, hey, I'm not sure if you've seen this project that I've been doing, but I think you might like it. I really shy away from just automatically signing people up. I want them to like opt into it. So I haven't.
That means that you're not gross.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Paul.
Yeah. Well, like one technique that I have heard of is like, well, you just like go to your entire contact list and you just start sending it to everybody, which I suppose that gets you more readers, but I don't know. It at the same time, it feels like a little too much, maybe. But I have wondered, okay, like what would be appropriate? Do I like send an individual email to somebody and say, like, hey, I'm catching up, but I also wanted to let you know, like, I've been doing this thing on the side for a year and a half. You might like to read it. If so, here's how you do it.
I think that's an approach that I'm comfortable with and I've heard of. And I think that kind of make that like tactical in case anybody cares. Having like a form thing that you then send out, copy and paste like individually to everybody is probably a kind of good happy medium between, you know, you're not writing 500-600 individualized letters, but at the same time you're kind of comfortably getting your idea in front of your people in a way that doesn't feel spammy if you kind of copy and paste and change the name and stuff like that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Anything else you'd do differently?
Yeah, I'm just thinking like I don't think so. So I you know, the topics that I'm writing about, unless I were to make them a little more like pop culturally, I don't know, like a lot of them are, they're either pretty long tail, so I'm just thinking of people coming in from a Google search, you know, they're either like pretty long tail or or some of them are just like incredibly competitive, so I don't know that I would or could really do anything just related to optimizing discoverability.
Yeah.
Other than I just stop writing about this topic and I write about something else. So,
yeah. But there's something about maybe making them a bit more rock and roll or like kind of sprinkling in something that's a little bit more rock and roll in the midst of what you'd normally rewrite of, at least in the, maybe in the headline and the lead or something, to kind of get a little more shareability or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it might not be me. That's the only thing. But yeah, my titles are not great. Like that I know is a fact. Okay. And I often discover that like after a week after I post the thing. So I don't know that, you know.
One thing that I had a previous guest who talked about that. They said they do, they have a Slack channel that's the title Slack channel. So whenever they get a post or whatever ready, they try to come up with a bunch of different titles kind of together. Mm. The kind of today hit takeaway I had from that was like, don't be afraid to workshop it with your friends before you hit publish.
Oh, interesting.
And then secondly, she said too, like, don't be afraid to switch it to the better title after the fact. Like the slug will stay the same probably on your website, but you can change the title after the fact and there's no harm, no foul really.
So you're just changing the title or are you also changing the URL? And then
URL probably stays the same in that case because you've kind of already put that out there.
Yeah.
But then future searches and future shares and stuff like that kind of reflect the better title.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I haven't really taken that approach of like going back to old posts and trying to optimize them. And yeah, I'm sure it makes sense to do that. The thing I would like to be able to build up to is where I have enough of a readership where I could have some type of readers forum, you know, whether it's a Slack group or, you know, something else where the readers could get to know each other.
So what do you think, what would you consider enough to try something like that out?
I would guess you've got to be, I don't know, maybe it's approaching like 5,000 readers, 5,000 like, you know, emails, I'd say. I'm just trying to estimate, like, you know, how many of them are really active at any given time or like actually like, you know, reading it. Say if it's still around 40%, and then, you know, yeah, maybe you don't even need that many. Maybe a couple thousand.
So you're almost there.
Almost.
Halfway there.
Halfway there.
I heard about either a baby or a cat in the background. I'm wondering, what advice would you have for somebody who's about to start or thinking about starting a newsletter now?
Similar to what I said in the beginning, you know, like throw yourself into a topic that you enjoy, that's going to allow you to learn. And, you know, when you are ready, put out that, you know, that social pressure, like you're making a commitment, even if there's, you know, people can't really do anything, you know, to you, if you don't live up to the commitment. But you have a little bit of that social pressure, like, I'm going to let down a handful of people if I don't publish this, and that certainly has kept me at it. I think you'll find if you choose, you know, your focus area well, and you can always change this, of course, but if you choose it well or get to the right place eventually, it's a great way of tricking yourself into learning, and I think you emerge like a stronger individual, you know, if you like stick to a project like this.
Thank you for sharing all that. Where can people find you online if they want to subscribe to your newsletter or follow you on your socials?
So I chose a very long, you know, in fact, I chose two long words to put together, but it's called
classic.
It's called unintended consequences. So if you write that as one word and then put the dot before the ES.
Okay.
So it's not .com. It's, you know, unintended consequences.
Clever.
You know, one word and then put the dot before the ES. Or you could just search unintended consequences blog and I show up.
Nice one. And if they're going to follow you on the socials, you said Twitter's
Twitter
the best
is the
one?
Yeah, Twitter's the best. It's just at P Orlando. PORLANDO.
Nice one, Paul. Well, thank you very much for sharing your time and your experience with us today. And by us, I mean me and very few other people who will listen to this. But I really got a lot out of it, and really nice to meet you.
Yeah.
You're generous with your subscribers.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks. It's just cool.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed it, I'd love to hear about it on Twitter or comment on this post. Until next time, take care.